Welcome to the PEDS Ethics Podcast, where we talk to leaders in pediatric bioethics about a hot topic or current controversy. Here's your host, John Lantos, from the Children's Mercy Bioethics Center in Kansas City.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the PEDS Ethics Podcast, coming to you from Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm John Lantos, Director of the Bioethics Center at Children's Mercy, and we are thrilled today to have with us my dear friend, Rosamond Rhodes, who is also Professor and Director of Bioethics Education at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, Professor of Philosophy at the Graduate Center, CUNY, and a Professor of Bioethics and Associate Director of the Clarkson Mount Sinai Bioethics Program. Thanks so much for joining us, Professor Rhodes.
Thank you, Dr. Lantos, and thank you for that generous and lengthy introduction.
Yeah, now we're going to talk about a paper that you published in 2014 called Is the Best Interest Standard Good for Pediatrics? We use that with our bioethics certificate program students, and it always generates a lot of discussion. Let me start with something that you start with. You make your views perfectly clear. You say we argue that at the very least, reliance on the best interest standard is subjective, leads to behavior that is intolerant and polarizing. It can be vague, misleading, egocentric, irrelevant, and unjust. Do you still feel that way?
Yes, I actually just reviewed the piece in preparation for our discussion today, and I think I stand by all of those claims.
Those are some pretty harsh words. Could you tell us why you have such criticisms of the best interest standard?
There are lots of reasons. So starting with an understanding of what is autonomy, which may sound a little bit like out in left field, but I think the essence of respect for autonomy is presuming that the person you're looking at, the person who's making decisions in front of you, is making them for good reasons. And what an autonomous person can do is they make decisions based on their values, their commitments, their goals. And while there are values and commitments and goals that are common to everyone, even when we share those values, we can prioritize them differently in different circumstances. And then a person also has their own idiosyncratic goals and values, my commitments to my children and grandchildren, my religious views, all will be part of my package of goals and commitments. And to respect autonomy is to allow somebody to prioritize those values for themselves and act on them. And when you as a physician or a bioethicist decide what's best for a person, what you're doing is you're giving priority to your own personal values and priorities, which may be very different from another person's. And it's as if you're saying only my values and my priorities and my ranking counts and yours do not. So I find that inherently disrespectful. So that's the starting point.
So children are not autonomous, though, especially young children. How would this apply to them?
Well, there we're dealing with surrogates, their parents, who are the presumptive surrogates. And as presumptive surrogates, they usually, almost always, care deeply about their children, care more for their children than themselves. But if you're a parent with more than one child, you have similar commitments to your other children. You know about your resources and your circumstances. And as any good parent, you have to take all of those factors into consideration. What's good for Jane might be very bad for Bob. And you have to weigh and balance those different considerations. And when you say to a parent, you, the doctor, the bioethicist, say that you must only think about what is in the best interest of Jane, you are ignoring this parent's other commitments and responsibilities that they are balancing. And we don't think a parent should only focus on one of their children's interests. They have to take them all into account, and the family's interests in keeping food on the table and the rent paid. And life is not that simple of giving anyone the luxury of only focusing on one concern.
So is this sort of the view that parents are essentially utilitarian rulers of their family and they have to maximize total well-being or total happiness within the family? And that may mean sometimes sacrificing the interests of one family member?
Well, I wouldn't want to say utilitarians, because utilitarians pick out one thing as being the good and they maximize that. What we often do in life is have many goals. I care about the education of my children, as well as their health, and as well as the development of their interpersonal skills and our standing in the community. So if I have multiple goals, not just one thing like pleasure or happiness or life years, then I'm not a utilitarian. Then I'm being a consequentialist. And I think that's what we do. We think about the immediate and long-range consequences of our actions, and there are many different ones. So I think a utilitarian only focuses on one, and I have a general problem with oversimplification of ethics, and that's the criticism of utilitarianism. So in Britain, they focus on quality-adjusted life years. That's utilitarian. It's focused on one thing. But what the good parent does is they're constantly balancing not just John and Bob and Mary and Sue, but they're balancing different things that they're trying to achieve for their family. So it becomes a lot more complicated.
Yeah, in the paper you give a bunch of different cases, but then end up developing an alternative model that still allows for some oversight or overriding of parental decision-making by doctors. Can you talk a little bit about how you would approach decisions when doctors think parents want something that, in the doctor's opinion, is not good for the child?
So this is our three-box model, and that paper was written with Dr. Ian Holtzman, who was at the time chair of our ethics committee. I was secretary to the ethics committee, and we would sit beside each other at an ethics committee meeting and say, is this a case in the middle box or the extreme boxes? So the idea here is just giving us a heuristic for thinking through these complicated matters. So when you're dealing with an adult patient making decisions for themselves, the doctor may lay out several alternatives that the doctor thinks are all within the reasonable range and allow the patient to choose. Now, the doctor may have their own idea of what is best, but they allow their patient to take into consideration all the factors that are relevant to the patient's life and make a decision. So this three-box model describes a box in the middle where there are all of the reasonable decisions that a patient could make for themselves or that a surrogate could make on behalf of a patient. And then there are the extremes of much too demanding, paying much too much value to the interests of the patient and much too little attention to the interests of the patient. So those are the extremes, and we should avoid the extremes. But when a decision made by a patient for themselves falls in the middle box, or the decision made for a patient by a surrogate falls in the middle box of acceptable, reasonable decisions, we should go with the surrogate's decision.
Let me just be clear for listeners what these three boxes or three circles are. You start with one extreme where cases are likely to have poor outcomes regardless of any interventions that are done, right?
Correct.
And is that the same or similar to what people have talked about as being medically futile or inappropriate treatment?
People would call that inappropriate treatment. So if you're prolonging the life where there's a lot of pain for the patient and no reasonably expected benefit to come from enduring more pain. You're merely extending the dying process, and a surrogate wants you to keep the patient alive so they experience more pain, or whatever their reasons are, but that's the effect. The person will not regain consciousness, not regain awareness, will not get any physically better or cognitively better, and will surely die. Then I think that's a really terrible choice, and we should try to discourage people from going that way. Legally in the United States, people are allowed to make those choices, except they're not allowed to refuse pain medication. But there are sometimes situations where the pain is intractable, even with the pain medication. The other extreme, where there's likely to be a very significant benefit with treatment and a disaster without treatment. So in that case, we will not allow surrogates to refuse the highly beneficial treatment that would save a patient's life. So an example would be the child getting a blood transfusion, and the child can have 70 or 80 years or 90 years of future good life with a blood transfusion, and is likely to be dead in hours if they don't get it. We're not going to allow families to refuse those clearly unreasonable.
So that sounds a lot like a best interest judgment.
Well, you're saying there that it's in the child's interest. I don't know why you need the word best. It's the word best that gets me all riled up. I can say more about that.
It's in the child's interest to be alive rather than dead and have a good long life. You just don't want to make it a priority that would override perhaps the interests of others?
Well, in that extreme case, the child with the blood transfusion, it really doesn't have to do with the interests of others. In the intermediate box, I would think that a family can take the interests of all the members of the family and even interests of their community into account in making their decision.
So let's just clarify the intermediate box. That's where it's not clearly likely to have a poor outcome regardless of the intervention, and also not clearly likely to have a significant benefit that couldn't be achieved without the intervention. So that middle box is pretty broad in your view. Is that correct?
It depends on where you are in the hospital. So it may be in the emergency room, that middle box might be the small box, but on a regular hospital floor in the newborn intensive care unit, that may be the biggest box. So I think it will depend on where you are in terms of medical care. When you're in the pediatrician's office, that's likely to be the biggest box, the intermediary box, where there are different options and you can do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and they're all within the reasonable range.
And it's usually not an immediate life-threatening situation like the blood transfusion.
Correct.
So who gets to decide which box a particular decision should be assigned to?
I think that has to be the medical professional's job. So I think the important point that the paper makes is that the decisions made by surrogates are different from the decisions made by clinicians. And the clinicians have to be very careful to stay in their lane. Their job is to rule out the unacceptable decisions, to lay out the options clearly so that the person with the authority to make the decision, which is the surrogate, the parent, they get to make the decision. So clear communication, total transparency, and then the clinician draws the limits. We're not letting you prolong suffering, no pain, you can't refuse pain medication, and at the other end, if this is very likely to be life-saving, you can't make that decision, the rest is up to you. Now, those are the guidelines for the clinician. And the surrogate, the parent making a decision, can think about what is best absolutely for my child, or if they can think, given the totality of what I have responsibility for achieving, what's a good decision for my child and my family. So the thinking of the family, and if they want to think in terms of what is best for my loved one, they're welcome to do it. But then the clinician has the authority, I would think, and the responsibility to set the limits of that authority, to draw the lines on what would be going out of bounds.
I mean, one set of critiques of the best interest standard is that it is aspirational, but not really practical. That is, we generally want to do what's best for children in our care. But as you say, to prioritize that over everything else is not to give due weight to other important considerations. And often people who make that criticism say that the harm principle is a better standard for intervention. We don't need to aspire to what's best for a child, but we do have an obligation to make sure the child will not be harmed by a decision. Is that close to your view on this?
Well, the harm part is we're ruling out the extremes of what will be extremely harmful in terms of denying a significant benefit or extremely harmful in prolonging pain. But the aspirational part, I think, is problematic because unless you as a doctor have a single patient, you're not going to be able to meet the standard of acting in the best interest of your patient. If what would be best for your patient is to be there hovering over them 24/7 and you have other patients, you're not going to be able to do what's best for your patient. I think having a standard that no one can meet either creates great moral distress needlessly, or it's too easily dismissed. Nobody can meet that standard, so I can forget about it. So I think it's much more preferable to have a standard that you can actually meet. I want to concern myself with trying to do what's in the interest of my patient. In essence, all I'm objecting to is the word best. And I think that gets us into a lot of different problems. One is this unrealistic problem. Another is it sets up the situation to be combative.
Yeah, you talk about being polarizing.
That's polarizing. So if I know what's best and you're picking something else, then you're wrong. So now we're ready to fight. So the clinician, the neonatologist is ready to fight with the nurses and the social worker and the parents. And I don't think that's a conducive environment for practicing medicine. And even if it's not about what is the best thing to do, but how is best to achieve that goal, again, we can have different views. And this polarizing element of giving somebody the job of thinking about what's best is just counterproductive in our medical environment.
In the paper, you present a bunch of different cases, and in most of them, it seems that people did not get into intractable disagreements, but in fact sat down and talked about options in what seemed to be a civil discourse. Is that your experience as an ethics consultant, that most of the time these seemingly difficult decisions can be worked out with a little goodwill and open-mindedness? Or do you see decisions becoming polarizing and intractable because people are applying the best interest standard?
I've seen some of each. So when you have everyone saying, yes, we share the common goal of trying to do what's good for your loved one, that sets a tone of trying to come together and figure out what that is. And it's very different from somebody feeling that they have the high ground because they know what's best. One of the examples we give in the article was an example of our residents bringing up a case to the ethics committee about a child who was, after weeks and weeks of trying to diagnose the child's problem, the child was diagnosed with a terrible genetic abnormality, one of the kinds of abnormalities that made him unable to digest certain proteins, and it was incompatible with life. So up until that point, the parents were very willing to go along with whatever the doctors recommended. They were very attentive, caring, loving parents, and they were a young couple from Mexico. And when the diagnosis finally came out, the parents said, well, they wanted to take home their child and try Mexican medicine and feeding the child Similac. So you can imagine easily that people in their community used cans of formula and they had healthy children and the parents wanted to try that. And the residents were extremely upset because they had found one formula that was tolerated somewhat. So instead of the child going to die in days or weeks, the child might live a couple of months. And they were objecting to the parents wanting to take the child home and feed the child Similac. And they really couldn't hear anything else. If this was best, how could we let the parents take the child home and do second best or third best or something that could be harmful to the child? And I just didn't see it because the child was going to die regardless. And I think the interests of the parents in feeling that they had tried everything was also a value that we shouldn't have overlooked.
Well, that is a great case to finish up with. It illustrates how different people can look at the same case, come to different conclusions about which box it belongs in. So ultimately, it seems
right.
The standards rely on people applying them in a reasonable fashion.
So the sum total of my objection is just to the word best. I think we should always focus on what is in the interest of our patients.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about this. We've been talking with Professor Rosamund Rhodes, who's director of the bioethics education at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. I'm John Lantos, and this is the PEDS Ethics Podcast, coming to you from Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for listening.